Final presentation is by Daniel Elke. He is at the Department of Health Policy and Management at SUNY Downstate. So, Daniel.
All right. Well, I want to start out today with a few thank yous. Always a good idea to get the audience, everyone in the room, on your side, if you will, especially if you're going last, or the icing on the cake, if you will. First of all, I'd like to thank my fellow panel members, Melanie, Raj, the co-authors. I'm very honored to be in the company of such exceptional scholars, and those were fantastic presentations both. I want to thank our moderator, Connie, who actually pronounced my name correctly. That is not easy. I am very happy about that, so thank you. And I also wanted to thank you. As you often hear on airplanes, when you're about to start on a trip, we know you have many choices when it comes to panels, and we're glad you chose ours, okay? I know we have even a few that had, like, the photographs of the members and everything, some of those very special panels, if you will, but yet you're here. We appreciate that. Thank you. All right. Today, I am going to speak a bit about a study that is very much a work in progress on Medicare market mechanisms, and I say that this is indeed a very enduring idea. As we said, I am at the SUNY Downstate School of Public Health, and if anyone's curious about where that is, it is smack dab in the geographic center of Brooklyn, East Flatbush to be exact. All right. I have no commercial interests, conflicts, et cetera, to report, first of all. Let's start out with a bit of a palate cleanser. I don't know if it's a cleanser, really, a palate dirtier, perhaps. I don't know. Depending on your point of view, obviously. This is a quotation from someone who's been in the news quite a bit lately, and that is Representative Paul Ryan, Republican from Wisconsin. And here he is talking about the Medicare program and a bit about the direction in which he would like to see it move. So I'll just read this really quickly. These reforms ensure the affordability by fixing the currently broken subsidy system and letting market competition work as a real check on widespread waste and skyrocketing health costs. Putting patients in charge of how their healthcare dollars are spent will force providers to compete against each other on price and quality. That's how markets work. The customer is the ultimate guarantor of value. What is not to love? Absolutely. And this quotation really sums up the ideals that really underpin many of what I am going to call market mechanisms within Medicare, the idea of valuing choice, of fostering competition among providers and other actors within the healthcare system, and widening options, and really just empowering patients, and yes, calling them consumers in many cases, which carries its own fraught baggage. So let's move on and just to answer the basic question, what are Medicare market mechanisms? There was a misprint in the program, actually, and said mechanism, so you may have been wondering, what's this market mechanism? I'm actually talking about plural market mechanisms, if you will. And what is fascinating to me is that, you know, we tend to associate a particular type of Medicare market mechanisms, a premium support plan, with Paul Ryan, and we think that perhaps this is a fairly recent phenomenon, maybe going back to the 80s and 90s, the pro-market zenith, if you will, that the Reagan era. However, what we have found is that it goes back quite a bit further. And interestingly enough, Medicare managed care, that is the participation of certain health maintenance organizations, we see going back all the way to the very beginning of Medicare, just about, and this was formalized in the amendments of 1972, which many of you will be familiar with. Perhaps most famously, these were the amendments that added end-stage renal disease as a category of care that would be funded by Medicare. However, also within those amendments were details on how HMOs were to be paid within the context of Medicare and sort of the terms of their participation. So what we see from a very early date is, yes, a little bit of expansion into new domains, the idea of trying to broaden services, but at the same time trying to instill competition, at least in some limited form, and involving the private sector in what at the beginning appeared to be a somewhat monolithic public program, what the closest that the United States comes to a single-payer system. What we see, however, is that almost from the very start, we actually have quite a bit of participation on the part of the private sector in various capacities, and indeed we have these market mechanisms from a very early date. Another form of market mechanism that I'd like to discuss a bit are the so-called premium support ideas. They are perhaps most prominently represented by the so-called Ryan plans. There have now been multiple Ryan plans. There are also, however, many earlier manifestations, including early ideas that go back to the late 70s, really, of effectively turning Medicare into a voucher. It might interest some of you to know the political pedigree of this as well. In the late 70s, early 80s, there was actually a very early voucher legislation, and it was championed by not only David Stockman, who would go on to become Ronald Reagan's budget director, but Richard Gephardt. Not someone you necessarily immediately associate with competition in Medicare. And it gives you an idea that at that very early day, 1970s, this was at least to some extent a bipartisan idea, the idea of bringing in competition to a large extent. That would change, however, and become more closely associated with the Republican Party or parts of the Republican Party, although with some participation on the part of certain Democrats at various points in time. Another market mechanism, competitive bidding. And here I place under this category competitive bidding for pricing of services, but also of durable medical equipment, which is something that has really taken off, particularly in recent years, to the chagrin of some. And I include the idea of ACOs and prospective payment generally, not really a market mechanism per se, but it is designed to give more flexibility to providers in some cases and to get payments for better services. So I'll put that at the end with a question mark. Not really a classic market mechanism, but nonetheless something that is worth noting in this broader category of really instilling flexibility and choice within the Medicare system. Okay, very brief history, since we don't want to be here all afternoon. As many of you will recall, Medicare went into effect along with Medicaid in 1965. Does anyone know who the very first beneficiary of Medicare happened to be? Beneficiary number one. Does anyone want to yell it out? Okay, Truman, yes, exactly. Harry S. Truman was beneficiary number one, and that was because, of course, Truman worked very hard to develop a national health insurance system during his time in the presidency, the late 1940s, early 50s. After the end of that debacle, reformers narrowed their vision and decided to focus on populations that were thought to be more deserving, if you will, of benefits. And the elderly, many of whom were also in poverty at this time, seemed to very much fit the bill. And in order to sort of hit home the idea of poetic justice, they brought in Truman for a very public ceremony when Medicare was started, and he became the first beneficiary. And, of course, Medicare, Medicaid are passed as amendments, really, to Social Security, again, in the mid-60s. So what are some of the legacies of this founding moment? First of all, it was very much modeled after Social Security in that it is a contributory, at least partially contributory, the idea that you pay in benefits, get services later on. But also, these taxes are paid into a trust fund. And this worked to both the benefit of the program and has been the bane of the program because it allows those who would like to reshape Medicare to point to potential crisis in funding down the line by pointing to the trust fund crisis. And we've all seen these momentary crises. They happen every few years saying, well, basically tomorrow Medicare is going to go bankrupt, so we have to change it wholesale. So this was both a benefit and a bane, really. in that it had some stability of funding, but also led to some crises in terms of future funding. So by the early 70s already, Medicare is a program that is experiencing quite a few cost overruns. We now know that this was largely because President Johnson, who passed Medicare, probably lowballed the estimates as to how much it would cost. For those of you who witnessed the 2003 events, this should sound somewhat familiar. He basically hid projections that showed it would cost quite a bit more, and we now have tape and transcript that shows this to be the case. As a result, almost from the start, costs were higher than anticipated. So there was indeed very much an impetus to try to find ways to save money, okay? And that was one of the factors that led to the introduction of these early market mechanisms. Another factor was the idea that Medicare was limited in its scope of benefits. So one way to expand those benefits while still keeping costs under control would be to allow increased participation on the part of the private sector and hopefully harness competition within the marketplace to bring costs under control while giving people additional benefits, as we saw with Medicare Part D earlier today. So the HMO provision, as I said, was inserted into Medicare early in 1972, and it actually preceded the overall HMO Act, which went into effect in 1973. But like the HMO Act itself in 1973, if any of you have read Larry Brown's book on the topic, you'll know that the symbolism was more powerful at the time than the substance. In many cases, participation remained very, very low among early HMOs throughout the system as a whole, and this was also mirrored in Medicare as well. Very little participation. It remained a tiny, tiny program, covering perhaps at the beginning just thousands, which in a program of many millions is quite literally a drop in the bucket, to borrow a phrase. All right, however, Medicare managed care does not go away. Despite early failings, it is brought back in various guises throughout the course of the 1980s, 90s, and into the aughts, starting with Medicare risk contracting, moving on to Medicare Plus Choice and Part C, and later on Medicare Advantage. In many cases, different names for effectively the same sort of program with policy tweaks. Effectively, the difference between each of these different programs is trying to find the best way to pay those private participants in the Medicare market. And many scholars argue, actually, that we haven't found the right payment mechanism quite yet. But what really stands out is that despite the fact that through most of this period, this is a very small residual program, it remains very compelling, very attractive, all right? And it keeps coming up in the media, as I will show you in a bit, despite the fact, again, success is very much mixed, both when it comes to expanding benefits and certainly keeping costs down. In many cases, these private players had to be paid more, in fact, in order to be encouraged to participate in the market. And as I said, recently we revisited this idea of vouchers and premium supports, another market mechanism that really attempts to draw on the power of choice and the idea of seniors using both their own out-of-pocket payments and government funding as well. And, of course, we know the drawbacks to this as well, chiefly that many of the proposals, the payments from the government do not keep pace in many cases with healthcare inflation, do not come close to keeping pace with healthcare inflation, leading to increases in out-of-pocket payments. All right, I said that this was something that doesn't really go away, so my co-author, whom I should probably mention at this point, Jeremy Johnson at Carroll College in beautiful Helena, Montana. If you haven't been there, go. We have been doing a content analysis of all articles relating to Medicare from 1966 effectively to 2011 in the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal. And some of the early, again, this is very much a work in progress, we're still actually doing the content analysis, but these are some representative years and shows you the trends in how market mechanisms are covered by the media. As you can see early on, not much mention. Even though there is action, there are, you know, elements of market mechanisms going into effect. Mentions in the media are few to nil, really. It's only when we get to the 1980s that we very slowly have an uptick, but then you can see in recent years particularly really a boomlet there in 2003, and that is very much in association with the Medicare Modernization Act, of course. But then we go back down a little bit again once we get to 2009, and I would expect as we move forward in time to continue to see these sorts of troughs and ridges, if you will, but continue to see the fact that these market mechanisms are not going away, both in terms of actual policy being enacted and in terms of what the media is latching onto and reporting on, okay? So if we take this and look at just the Wall Street Journal alone, which as a largely pro-market, more conservative newspaper, would be expected to have perhaps a little more coverage, certainly, of market mechanisms. We see, again, that spike in 2003, but also 2008, 2011, and we're just continuing at a higher baseline, much higher baseline than we did in those opening years. But we're going to continue to likely see that as we move through time. Now, we've also been looking at the tone of that coverage, okay? Not simply the number of articles, which is a very raw count, obviously, but we've been looking at the tone of those articles, and it's a very interestingly mixed picture, including when it comes to the Wall Street Journal. In many of these years, a good half to perhaps over half of the coverage is negative in tone when it comes to market mechanisms. And you may ask, well, why would that be the case? In most of these articles, and we've gone through and read, at least scanned them, in most of these articles, it is because of a distrust as to the cost-cutting potential of market mechanisms. The idea that instituting greater choice is a good thing, but it's bursting the budget, in effect. And this trope particularly became prominent in the wake of 2003 and its aftermath. And the Wall Street Journal actually reported quite closely on the allegations that were made about the cover-up of the actual budget figures. So obviously some very negative coverage there in tone. So again, this is, again, just really at the start, we're really a work in progress right now when it comes to trying to find out not only how sustained the presence of market mechanisms in Medicare have been, but really why, perhaps, they have been so prominent. So, 2 minutes, okay. So a few possible explanations. First of all, they are very convenient for politicians. Okay, very convenient for politicians. If they are able to get up there and say, I have something that can both cut costs and give more benefits, effectively give you more for less, that's an extremely simplified way to describe it and effectively not borne out by the evidence in most cases, but very attractive to politicians. And in fact, it seems that in many cases, the roots of these plans are with political leaders, and in some cases, the thinkers who really make this their pet issue, including Elwood and Enthoven and others. And not necessarily in the industry, in business. Every now and then, insurers make positive noises. They'd like to be in the Medicare market, but what they really mean is they'd like to get greater federal funding, not necessarily, and they would not really like to have competition that's too tough, because they effectively just want to open that door to federal funding. So you see in many cases specific plans that are raised when it comes to market mechanisms that could be seen to increase competition, and yet insurers and others are quickly saying, well, we can't make enough money on this. This is a horrible idea. We like the system in some cases the way it is. So don't fool with it. So not necessarily organically coming from business, but really originating in many cases from these social entrepreneurs and political leaders. And again, one thing that we've been looking at is the idea that you repeat a mantra enough over time, and you can effectively make it true. Though anyone who is in advertising will tell you that repetition is key. Even if an idea does not have, perhaps, much in the way of evidence behind it, if you repeat it enough, it becomes a very much a closely ingrained trope. And I think that that's one of the reasons that we really have seen these marketizing ideas sustained through the years, despite the fact that through most of its history, Medicare, traditional Medicare, has been a very, very popular program. So why mess with success? These are just some hypotheses as to why that might be the case. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for staying on time. So do we have some questions? All right, so if you have to pick one,
Oh, I'm not done yet.
Absolutely. Okay, so if we have to pick one of those in the current situation, in this context, which market mechanism might have the most likelihood of actually getting some play and traction?
That's a terrific question. Thank you. And one that I've given some thought to, actually. I'm a little bit skeptical when it comes to premium support plans right now, despite the fact that I gave Paul Ryan sort of top billing. And that's because in his most recent plans, he's beginning to step back, it seems, a bit from championing them quite as stoutly as in the past. And lately, if you look at his quotes coming out, he is emphasizing much more smaller bore reforms, including charging wealthy more, if you will, differential charges in terms of Medicare, and moving away slightly, perhaps, from premium supports. And obviously, this has been something that has been brought up several times now and has been dead on arrival several times as well. So I'm a little bit skeptical about that. I think that we're going to continue to see elaboration, really, of the Medicare managed care sector. We've already seen that. The latest statistics are that 25% of beneficiaries actually are enrolled in Medicare Advantage now. So while if I had given this presentation just a few years ago, I would have been able to get off by saying that, well, Medicare Advantage is just a residual. We don't need to worry about it much. Today, it's a quarter of beneficiaries. It's not most, but that is a larger number, and it's something that is more and more difficult to ignore. And I think it's been fascinating to see what President Obama and the Affordable Care Act have tried to do around Medicare Advantage. There was that kerfuffle concern that funding would be cut to Medicare Advantage, and to some extent it is being cut, but the deepest cuts were effectively stopped in the end, and it appears that Medicare Advantage will be largely, at least for the next several years, left as is, and will likely continue to expand, certainly at least marginally, and so I think it has a very strong foothold now, and that will likely be the market mechanism that we're really going to be watching and left with the next few years.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes?
So isn't the reason that the insurers were not eager to get into Medicare is because the function of insurers is to stay away from anybody who might use them?
Absolutely, absolutely. That's a very good point, and that's actually why Medicare was begun in the first place. The idea that you have potentially the sickest individuals, those with the greatest amount of risk, simply it was not really good business to attempt to cover such individuals. And while we've seen improvements, I'll use that guardedly, improvements in underwriting techniques over the years that allowed them to slowly sort of make their way into the market and try to determine risk and adjust rates accordingly, obviously we're seeing that change again, so that the door is blocked partly under the Affordable Care Act. So absolutely. So, you know, insurers not eager to enter Medicare largely because this was not a population that was attractive to them. They simply did not feel that they could make a go of it. And once Medicare managed care got started, invariably they did not take to the fact that the HCFA, later CMS, was paying, of course, slightly less than they would for the average fee-for-service care in the region, the idea being that, well, they should be more efficient. Therefore, they get slightly less funding. That was not something they liked either. So if they were able to get word that, well, perhaps we could get bonus payments, perhaps there would be a way to increase that funding up to, perhaps over, the fee-for-service level, then it begins to look appealing. But as long as they're getting slightly less for a very risky population, that's not something they necessarily want to join. Yeah, absolutely.
Something about that 25% of Medicare recipients that are on Medicare Advantage, do you think we should have?
Well, I actually, that's something that I would want to look into next. These are many of those who are in Medicare Advantage seem to go into it because they want the additional benefits in many cases, not necessarily because they feel, well, I need to be empowered, I want to have a choice. If anything, you know, as we've seen with the other presentations, there's too much choice, if you will. It's very hard to navigate. But as long as additional benefits go along as a sweetener, that's very attractive. So that's the main reason I think that we see. So those who would like increased benefits, those are the people who you find in Medicare Advantage. Well, yeah. Good. Thank you.